I am Brooke Wilkinson, and this is From Jelly Beans to Riding Horses. When considering degrees of difficulty, how about the problem of how to impress the President of the United States as a five-year-old? And by impress, I don't mean inspire or influence. I mean stand out to him or her. My mother and her twin are identical, not just in looks and peculiar sense of humor and decibel level, but also in imprinting on people's psyche. They are animated. They are theatrical. They sing a lot. My sister's cousins and I were born into this circus of twindom. I did not realize until much older that not every family aspires to be in Pepsi or M&M commercials by writing unsolicited jingles. Not everyone sends tapes to CEOs, to Oprah, to Rosie. So what about when you are invited to a meet and greet with the commander-in-chief? In 1983, our family asked that very question when we were invited to meet President Ronald Reagan privately in the Oval Office. Oh, no, no, you don't just shake hands and exchange pleasantries with the leader of the free world. You don't stand in awe of the fact that you are inside one of the most notable places with one of the most powerful people in the world. No, no. You sing. You sing made-up lyrics to the tune of Yankee Doodle Dandy. Luckily, I was five, so I was game. We got the go-ahead from the chief of staff after his required practice run. From pictures that are now part of our family archives, I had a death grip on my mother's hand, only letting go for that brief moment when the president shook my hand. After introductions came the singing. This is the part that has stayed with me for over 30 years. From jelly beans to riding horses, with Nancy always by your side. Thank you for the things you do that we might live in freedom. God bless you, Mr. President. God bless you, Mr. President. Ronald Reagan may have summoned his acting skills, but my five-year-old self was convinced that he genuinely loved it.
My name is Tom Slayton, and this is Nepali Farewell. About 5 years ago, I went trekking with three friends in the Himalayas in Nepal. As is the custom, we hired porters to help us carry the equipment we needed. As is not the custom, our porters were women. Dilmaya was in her early 30s, and her sister Bhima somewhere in her 20s. Both were married with children. A lifetime of hard labor had made no inroads on their beauty. Like many Gurung women, they looked more Tibetan than Indian, with slightly almond-shaped eyes, high cheekbones, and hair so black its highlight shone blue in the mountain sunlight. They smiled easily, were friendly, and unfailingly polite to us older trekkers. We soon came to regard them not as youthful employees, but as friends. They really couldn't make our trek easy. We were climbing several thousand vertical feet every day, but they did take much of the difficulty out of it. And here's the thing. Every day, these two diminutive, heavily laden women hiked us into the ground. Early each morning, Dilmaya would pop into my room. "You bag ready, Tom?" she would ask. I would hand over about 30 pounds of my load, shouldering maybe 15 pounds myself. Then we Westerners would move out, leaving the two women to divvy up our gear and follow us. And every day, at some point, They would steam past us, talking or singing, moving briskly along the trails that connect the mountain villages of Nepal. We would arrive at our day's destination to find them there already. In dangerous sections, they walked with us. Several times, as I ventured over a narrow log bridge or an exposed ledge, a thin brown hand would reach back to steady me. Once, Dilmaya saved me from being attacked by a large Tibetan sheepdog. All too soon, our trek of several days was over with a bus waiting to take us out of the mountains. Bhima and Dilmaya were sitting at the tea house watching us, and I knew I would never see them again. Not in this lifetime, anyway. And that, my friends, was the part that was truly difficult.
Good afternoon. I'm Bill Schubart, and this is called Terror in the Sky. By all admissions, travel has become a misery. The very word travel comes from the French word travail, meaning work or burden. As a man of girth, I pay close attention to recent news reports about whether the airlines are planning to charge me by the pound, as they do in Polynesia, or reduce the seat width from 17 to 16 inches and my knee clearance to the diameter of my patella. On a recent transatlantic flight, our seatmate was clearly a well-accessorized traveler. After cocooning himself with his noise-canceling headphones, his Kindle, and an inflatable neck support that looked like a fur-bearing goiter, he reclined his seat onto the knees of the passenger behind and fell into a noisy, apnea-punctuated sleep. As the TV screen a few inches from my face showed an airplane icon over Ireland, our in-flight dinner service began. But first, we were invited to open an airline credit card account at usurious rates, theoretically offset by a promise that we'd never again have to pay to check our bags, but not mentioning that in our many years of travel, we'd never had to before. As a further inducement, there'd be no interest charges on any overpriced duty-free goods we might buy, at least for the first month. We were then offered a $10 sandwich and a $4 bottle of Evian water, or a free plastic cup of bluish tap water, and our choice of a free peanut, pretzel, or animal cracker. I took the sandwich with its soggy bun, mysterious pink membranes, wilted lettuce, and anemic tomato slices, and after staring at it for a few minutes, stuffed it into the seat back pocket to compost. Amidst the usual chorus of wheezing, gasping, hacking, and sneezing, the woman behind us launched into a series of bronchial spasms that led the terrified man next to her to urgently but unsuccessfully plead with the unsympathetic attendant to be reseated. Finally, the pilot, sounding like Charon paddling us across the River Styx in Dante's Inferno, announced our final descent. And as the cabin pressure increased, all the infants and toddlers aboard began a chorus of lamentation. As we touched down, my wife turned to me and said, "Now, was that so difficult?"
My name is Suzanne Spencer Rendall, and my piece is titled Small Change. In 2010, my daughter started half-day kindergarten in our small New Hampshire school. That meant that I got to juggle not just the demands of an infant son and full-time work, but also arrange to transport her midday to aftercare. She enjoyed 3 hours of school, and then she and I spent the rest of the day dealing with a piecemeal system of drop-offs and pickups. So as my extremely social and rambunctious son hit preschool, I began a quest to get the town to adopt full-day kindergarten. it didn't seem so radical. Roughly 80% of schools across the country had full-day K, and the educational benefits had been thoroughly documented. But in a small town, a seemingly small change can create big battles. The school board put forward an expensive plan for full-day K, and the town voted it down. I had 1 year left to get it passed. Working with the superintendent, I proposed a way to add the hours to the kindergarten day at a minimal cost. I got people from all over town to write the school board respectful letters supporting the plan. The board put it forward, but the battle continued. Some argued in hearings that a full day was too long and we should keep the half-day schedule for the children. After a mother in a hearing described the workarounds she had to cobble together for half-day kindergarten and how stressful it was for the whole family, an opponent argued that life is hard, and what a better time to learn this than in kindergarten. That, too, was for the children. In the end, the town passed full-day K. This year, my son is a pioneer. He's in our town's first-ever full-day kindergarten class. As I watch him step off the school bus every day at 3:30, beaming from 7 hours of art, reading, math, science, and recess, I'm reminded that small change can be difficult, but it's often worth the effort.
Hi, I'm Annie Guyon, and my story is called Not That There's Anything Wrong With That. When it came to college, my parents weren't exactly high pressure. Their mantra was, just be a secretary. Not that there's anything wrong with that. It just wasn't for me. They left school at 15 to help put food on the table and made it very clear that we weren't college people. Nevertheless, I graduated from high school at 16 with a grand plan to have a PhD by 24. But because they wouldn't drop me as a dependent on their taxes or sign financial aid forms, I couldn't even apply till that age. So my college experience wasn't typical. Instead of a dorm, I shared a flat with degree-owning, career-building roommates. I had two jobs, periodically taking semesters off to cover tuition. When studying, I often wore earplugs to block out my roommates' dinner parties, especially when their friends' young kids were running around squealing. And my life experience did come in handy. In women's studies, the freshly graduated professor often looked to me for feminist history, knowing little herself about titans like Steinem or Abzug. And my advisor waived several credits because I wrote a column for a London art magazine. On the downside, students sometimes thought I was a professor. In Biology 101, the newbie instructor lobbed a frozen banana to me during a safe sex lesson, suggesting that I show all these youngsters how to properly put on a condom, yielding freshman snorts all around. And working 50-plus hours a week while trying to carry as many course units as possible meant napping on long tables in unused art rooms to make it through my 16-hour days. Eventually, I earned my very first degree, a BA, at age 30. It was a character-building experience, and one or two sour grapes aside, helped make me who I am today. Now, my 18-year-old is a happy freshman at UVM. I'm taking his sister on her own college tours, and I'm more determined than ever to help them have a college experience that won't be quite so difficult.
Stephen Pappas. This is called Water Under the Press. As a news guy, I love a good story. Every town is full of them, and Vermont seems to have a greater share than most. Some of the time, journalists have to tease out a story, but most of the time, it comes right through the door, sometimes under difficult circumstances. The cynic in me jokes that the slogan for every newspaper really ought to be, "Your bad day is our good day." Despite what you see in the news, community journalism is alive and well. We are proof. Technology has made it easy to get local information to people faster than ever. The access to facts unfolds before our eyes, and many times organizations reverse publish content, taking the bits and pieces gathered all day long and combining them into a narrative that lays out a proper context. 5 years ago this month, the news came through the door of my daily newspaper in the form of 4 feet of water. A late May storm dumped several inches of rain on central Vermont, and it pooled in downtown Barrie, turning the streets to canals. In a matter of hours, as the water rose outside, my newspaper staff scrambled. We pulled together coverage of the flooding right up until midnight, when the bay doors gave way under the pressure of all that water, and our offices, including the newsroom, the press, a mountain of equipment, all of our archives, all fell victim to the deluge. Our final edition was coming off the press when the power to the building went out, and we got it out the door into the hands of our carriers who were waiting on higher ground. The flood claimed our offices, but not our spirit. Early the next morning, we started over, producing the next edition without an office, without a press, not even a dry room in which to meet. Technology kept us printing. Community kept us going. We never missed an edition. And now, 5 years later, we look back on that day as a darn good story.
Hello, I'm Keith Oppenheim. My piece is called A Writer's Uncertainty. A confession. When I start to write a commentary, I don't always know the ending. Hopefully, I do know the big picture of what I'm trying to say, but the process is rarely about certainty. It's more like trying to get somewhere without a GPS and being too stubborn or too afraid to ask for directions. The whole thing is harder than I'd like to admit. So you can imagine what it's like to teach students how to write. I'm now at the end of a semester in which I instructed a group of 11 to produce short documentaries. They wrote and rewrote. These students can work independently, but I try to encourage them to work in teams of two and benefit from collaboration. The results were mixed. In one case, there were two students I put together. One student's project was flopping, the other needed help. I thought giving that failing would mean they wouldn't graduate on time. They were better off as a team. But it turned out they were better at fighting with each other than writing with each other. As producers, what they tended to do was spill rather than craft. They let interviewees do the talking, often without context. So for a while, they had people saying a lot of things, but it wasn't really clear what these people were saying at all. I nagged, I pushed, I mediated. I worked on the script with them, trying to shape their material into a narrative. And it all reminded me of me. But instead of one person fighting inside his own head, here were two people battling it out. Ultimately, they crossed the finish line. And I suppose, if I were to ask them months from now, was that so difficult, they'd downplay how difficult it actually was. But, of course, it's always different when you're in the middle of a crisis, when the feeling is there's a lot on the line and you don't know how it's going to end.
Hello, my name's Rich Nadworny, and this is Hidden Agenda. Believe it or not, about 25 years ago, I was the first person in the history of Swedish television to use a hidden camera in a documentary. One of Sweden's best investigative journalists was a friend, and he was working on a film to expose scamming doctors. Since I was dark and American, he thought I'd be a better liar than the pale, blushing Swedes. You could tell he hadn't done this before. His team gave me a small, very purple case for the camera. How about black, I suggested. The lens poked out of an unzipped opening. Don't worry, no one will notice, they said. They could only get 30-minute videotapes, and of course in the first doctor's waiting room, I waited and waited. I had turned on the camera before I went in, so I had to keep running to the bathroom to rewind the tape. Not exactly the vision I had of suave espionage. But the first visit was a success. I wanted the doctor to say that I had mental health problems so I could get a state-funded apartment in downtown Stockholm. A few thousand kroner changed hands, and I left with everything on tape. The second doc supposedly fixed gunshot wounds in the middle of the night for organized crime. As soon as I walked into his office, he asked what the purple bag was and why was there a camera lens sticking out of it. He actually moved the bag so it wasn't facing him. Mind you, this so-called mafia doctor now had my Swedish ID number, which meant he could find out everything possible about me. The visit was unsuccessful, and I decided not to sleep in my apartment that night, just in case. Eventually, the documentary aired to great success. Investigations started, licenses were suspended. Naturally, both of my two doctors sued the TV station, resulting in two high-profile trials with Sweden's two most famous lawyers and me on the witness stand twice. From this experience, I learned two things. Being first is never easy. And when someone offers you a job because they think you're a good liar, just say no.
I'm Martha Molnar, and my piece is titled Green Grandma. I'm the green grandma, the one who makes the little boys transport soil between garden beds and toy trucks and gives compasses and bug catchers instead of normal toys. The one who lets them fill the glass hummingbird feeders and hang out in the vegetables, stripping every last cherry tomato. I also bribe them shamelessly, promising lavish picnics and thrilling stories on every hike. They never forget about the picnics, but within minutes of entering the deep woods, they usually forget about the stories, which I see as the opening I need to impart lessons about everything around us. I teach them how to identify trees and marvel at how they turn air, light, and soil into maple syrup. I teach them how to identify different birds and find them on my phone app. We talk about how giant the icebergs were to drag the massive boulders they climb on. And we try to sit silent and still by pools for never enough minutes, waiting for frogs and turtles to show. I point out the amazing variety of greens on a hillside and how to guess where the waterfalls would be. But one day last summer, one of the little boys asked me to stop. Just stop. He was seconded by the next oldest as the littlest one, ignoring all of us, lay down in the moss and stared up at an enormous hemlock that may have been there since the Ice Age. He closed his eyes and smiled. I'm listening to the wind, he said, still smiling. It's singing me a song. Now he wants me to sing him a song. And sitting up, he sang in a high, off-key voice. The bear went over the mountain, the bear went over the mountain. He stopped. And then we were all still, all of us lying on the moss, listening to the wind, which together with the silence of moss drowned out my superfluous teaching. And like all important lessons, it was so hard.
Okay, hold on a second. My name is Tim McQuiston, and this piece is called Feeling the Burn, 2017. In the 1990s, the hottest property on the national Republican stage was John McCain. He was a Vietnam War hero. He was a real man. He wrote a popular book. He even was politically adroit enough to have dodged a Senate ethics inquiry. All he had to do was wait for the Bill Clinton era to end, and he would run and be elected president. But the political establishment didn't really like him. He was a bit of a loose cannon politically who didn't always toe the GOP line. He was often too cozy with Democrats, including Clinton. The powers that be calculated that he would not offer enough separation from the presumptive Democratic candidate for president. So after a bitter primary loss in which even his war record was called into question, he returned to the Senate to wait out another 8 years. For his acquiescence, he was handed the nomination to face Barack Obama. But his heart never seemed into it. The GOP even forced a running mate on him. So what does all this have to do with Bernie Sanders? A lot. McCain may have gone quietly back to being a U.S. senator. Bernie Sanders will not go quietly anywhere. By this time next year, one of these outcomes will be true. Bernie will be president, vice president, ambassador to Israel, secretary of labor, or short of that, he will continue his movement of progressive politics, even if it's as a senator in a minority party. He's come too far and shown too much chutzpah to lay aside his nearly genderless, colorblind candidacy. He's gathered millions of followers and raised millions of dollars. He's worked too hard to just set all that aside. But nor can he be the rabble-rousing outsider for which he's made a name. To at least sustain the movement, he must evolve. He'll be changed, and will change accordingly. Whatever Bernie is now as a candidate, a year from now, he'll be something else.
Okay. My name is Mary McCallum, and the name of this piece is Ice Cream Man. In the summer of 1965, my father, Paul, lost his sales job in a department store. He had plenty of bills, no savings, and five kids and a wife to support. He'd grown up fatherless during the Great Depression, two challenges that taught him to be resourceful. My mother stretched the food supply by taking us kids to the nearby woods every day to pick wild blueberries. And my father, knowing it was going to be a sweltering Long Island summer, decided to become an ice cream man. At first, he drove for good humor, but quickly learned he'd make more money if he went independent. He bought an old used refrigerator truck, painted it white, and lettered Paul's Ice Cream on both sides in red. Dressed in white pants, white shirt, and a white pith helmet he found in our barn, he headed out each morning to a warehouse to pick up ice cream novelties that he hoped to sell that day. In the mid-60s, Long Island was sprouting housing developments as fast as farmers could be convinced to sell their land. It was in these sprawling subdivisions that my father's best customers lived. At the end of the day, Dad would empty his pockets onto the kitchen table and eject a pile of change from the shiny metal coin changer he wore strapped to his belt. It was never a lot, but it made a powerful visual for us kids to behold of the fruits of his labor. We helped count the change into little silver towers and rolled them into small paper tubes for the bank deposit. My father was no ordinary ice cream man. He wore a jungle helmet and taped sheets of white paper on the sides of his truck so kids could draw pictures on them with crayons. He turned job loss into an adventure. He sold a product that made people happy. When he was in his 90s, I asked if that long ago summer had been that difficult. He thought a moment and said, "Nope, best job I ever had."
Hello, my name is Michael Martin, and this is called The French Facts of Life. Every parent knows that at some point they have to give the talk. And when I say the talk, I want to be clear. I mean S-E-X. Except French parents don't do this. They don't schedule nature walks or take the long way home from hockey practice so they can try to offhandedly bring up the birds and the bees. And they don't invite their teens to sit down awkwardly on the couch to talk about precautions and how our bodies are different. Nope. The French break it down for their kids naturally, as it comes up, and just try to make it age appropriate. Did I mention that my wife is French? Well, one day she was driving our sons back from swim practice. They were 4 and 6, respectively. And Joshua, then a precocious 6-year-old, asked from the back seat, "How do you make babies, Mom?" There's a pause, naturally, and a hush falls over the car. Just the sound of the turn signal blinking, of tires crunching over snow, of Theo sucking his thumb pensively next to his big brother. So my wife explains, when you really love someone, and about plumbing features, and how, in order to make a baby, a man puts his ZZ inside a woman's zezette, so the little seed can swim and find an egg, and so on. Another hush falls over the car, but this time more complete and intense. Theo has stopped sucking his thumb. My wife keeps driving, but also cranes her neck backward to catch any reactions to this big revelation. An even longer pause. It's as if through the silence, my wife can hear the sound of cognition, of brains churning and burning and working really, really hard. Finally, Joshua breaks the silence. "Wow, I guess a man has to be really brave to do that." My wife laughs so hard she cries, but manages to keep the car on the road, just barely.
I'm Bill Mayers. This is called Not Difficult, But Not Easy. I took up teaching high school in middle age. "That wouldn't be so hard," I said. "I came from 4 generations of teachers. I had a good education. I'd done a lot of different things, like journalism and politics. I took my required courses at St. Michael's College, including an observation class called Teacher as Decision Maker. I was a volunteer teacher at the Chittenden County Correctional Center. And then I landed a job at Milton High School, 4 weeks into the school year, teaching 5 history classes and 110 students. They were waiting for me, but not in the way I expected. They'd been sharpening their deportment knives on a substitute teacher. And from the first day, subject matter took a back seat to classroom management. Several kids were masters of truculence, the kind that just borders on insult, while the rest seemed to enjoy the show. And I told myself, well, at least they're not convicts. For 3 weeks, I dreaded going to school. I got so nervous in one class that I started writing on the wall instead of the whiteboard with a permanent marker. You couldn't lecture for more than 5 minutes at a time. They were testing me. I was testing myself. I tried different things. I fell back on my love of history and the ad hoc stage of a classroom. I brought in guest speakers. I dressed up in a three-piece suit and mimicked William Jennings Bryan Cross of Gold speech. I worked out debates. I gave lots of short quizzes. My secret game was to trick them into learning. And gradually, I felt the ground shifting. Those rows of two-dimensional faces deepened into three-dimensional personalities. I became confident enough to show them I cared about them, because I did. By year's end, I was proud that I had learned and obeyed the commandment of my best teacher at St. Mike's, who had said, "Your job is to raise every kid in your classes at least one notch."
Well, I'm Lang, and this is called Nothing to It, You Know How. Summer of 1958, I think, I was working as a guide at the Osable Club in the Adirondacks. It was an idyllic situation. Row the clients up the beautiful Osable Lakes to camp, lug the food and the booze across the carry, cook, build the fires, tell stories, and sing songs in the evening after supper. One family, very nice people, they had a kid who wasn't quite as nice as his parents. He was into everything, played with his food, made messes. He had a bow and arrow set that he carried everywhere, firing arrows at whatever struck his fancy. He never hit anything he aimed at, as far as I know, but he was clearly a menace. One afternoon, as his father watched him stalk a red squirrel, the dad said, "You know anything about bows and arrows, Will?" "Oh, yes," I said. Real Adirondack guides never admit to not knowing everything. But for once, I wasn't exaggerating much. "Well, perhaps you could take him in hand and show him how to do it properly." I got the kid on the back porch of the camp, and out on the stump beside the woodshed about 50 feet away, I set an empty red and white 7-ounce Calumet baking powder can, the one with the Indian chief on the side in profile. "Now," I said, "watch me." I gripped the notch of the arrow properly between two fingers, pulled it up to my chin, aimed it, and let her fly. I hit that poor chief right in the eye, and the impaled can tumbled off the stump. The kid and his father were goggle-eyed, and I was thinking, you couldn't do that again in 50 years. I walked out to the woodshed, pulled the arrow out of the can, set the can back on the stump, and handed the bow and arrow to the kid, as casually as I possibly could. "See," I said, "you do it the right way, there ain't nothing to it."
Hi, I'm Jess Leahy, and my piece is called The Great Chocolate Shop Challenge. When the chocolate shop in Hanover, New Hampshire closed this year, we lost more than a source for our favorite treats. We lost a family landmark. Where other children find caramels, mint meltaways, and pop rocks, my son Finn found his courage. Gregarious in most other contexts, Finnegan would not, could not, he argued, enter stores by himself. No matter how many times I soothed, no matter how many times we rehearsed, his anxiety and fear won out. That's when a plan I like to call the Great Chocolate Shop Challenge was born. One day, after our errands were complete, I offered to take Finn to the chocolate shop for a treat. I drove up to the front of the building, pulled a $5 bill out of my wallet, and held it out to Finn, eager and expectant, in the back seat. "What?" he said, uncomprehending. "Go on," I said, "pick out whatever you'd like." His eyes moved from me to the bill and finally to the entrance of the shop. Long, silent seconds passed. "I can't," he said. "Okay," I said. I put the money into my wallet and drove away. This scene played out countless times over the next 2 years in various emotional shadings, some in anger, some in tears, but toward the end of the second year, stony, frustrated silence had emerged as Finn's default setting. Then, one afternoon in May, as I was about to tuck my money back in my wallet and drive away, the bill disappeared from between my fingers. A seatbelt clicked, a door slammed shut, and like that, I was alone in the car. 10 minutes later, Finn returned, clutching a white paper bag and a handful of change. "How was it?" I asked. "Fine," he said, nibbling on a dark chocolate pecan turtle. "I'm proud of you," I said. Finn said nothing, but I'm pretty sure I saw him smile as he popped a dark chocolate caramel into his mouth, turned back to the window, and watched the world race by.